I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of praying in public school and where the legal fight began. One of the earliest cases that went all the way to the Supreme Court involved a high school kid in Abington, Pennsylvania. Ellery Shemp is his name. One day in his junior year, Ellery brought a copy of the Quran to school, and he sat there reading that during the mandatory Bible study session. His teacher caught him and sent him to the principal's office. And that's what set off one of the key legal cases, which persuaded the courts that public schools are not the place for mandatory prayers. And I have to tell you something here. Every time I read about a kid who takes some kind of stand on an issue like this, I'm always suspicious. I always think that it's the parents who put the kid up to it. Ellery Shemp says no. He says he did it all by himself. And I'll talk with him about that Bible class right after the news. There's a new fight coming in the long argument over praying in public school. It's being waged over what's called the moment of silence. Lawmakers in the state of Illinois recently became the latest to pass a law requiring public schools to observe a brief period of time each day for, quote, silent prayer and for silent reflection on the anticipated activities of the day, unquote. A 14-year-old student at Buffalo Grove High School has gone to court seeking an injunction to stop this moment of silence. Her father is a radio talk show host and self-proclaimed atheist. The lawyer who's taken this case says silent prayer is still prayer. The case goes to court today. It's the latest in a 50-year-long battle to pray or not to pray in public school. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
If you're any kind of student of the history of school prayer, you'll know that there is a fat file full of cases involving various boards of education and people like Everson and Clausen, McCollum and Murray and Shemp. My guest today is one of these people, Ellery Shemp. When he was in high school, 50 years ago, in Abington, Pennsylvania, he put himself at the forefront of an historic Supreme Court case.
There was a law in Pennsylvania that required that, quote, the 10 verses of the Holy Bible must be read at the beginning of each school day in each school classroom. And that was followed by the recitation of the Lord's Prayer and then by the flag salute. The Lord's Prayer wasn't required by law, but it was a common custom. There was no choice. The teachers would be fired for not carrying out this practice. And it was called morning devotion, so there's no question that this was meant to be a devotional exercise.
So in high school, did one student get chosen to read out to the rest of the class, or did everybody just sit there and read to themselves?
Oh, no. One person had to stand in front of the classroom and read from the Bible out loud, 10 verses, without comment. That was very important, without comment, because the notion was that any commentary would turn out to be sectarian or favor one interpretation over another. When finally, in my last 2 years of high school, we moved into a brand new high school which had a public address system, and then there was a special group of students taking an English course in radio and TV and journalism or something, and one of those students then would read the Bible over the public loudspeaker, which came into every classroom and hallway.
Who decided which 10 verses were to be read?
Before the public address system, people would often just open the Bible totally at random. Could be from any book of the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, and start in the middle of nowhere and end in the middle of nowhere. But there was one very funny event I remember in junior high school. I think we were in eighth or ninth grade, and some kid read from the started reading all the begats. You know, there's a lot of begats in, in the New Testament and tracing the lineage of Jesus. And so the next student thought that was kind of funny, and he started reading more begats. And then it was my turn, and I thought I picked up on the joke when we started reading more begats. By the end of the week, the teacher came over and said, look, enough of all these begats. And I suspect that with all this begatting going on, it suggested too much sex for the junior high school students.
I guess I'm trying to figure out the tone of the times in which you began to think that maybe this was not the best thing for your high school class, because we're 10 years ahead of the 60s when the idea of protesting anything became in vogue. What was it that led you to think that, I don't know, this wasn't something that ought to happen in school?
Well, there had been the McCarthy era, this way of looking for communists and traitors under every bed, mm-hmm. and somehow attaching the notion of godliness as uniquely American in contrast to the so-called godless communists. Also, in our high school, there was a book titled The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, which sort of emphasized that don't stand out. Conformity was the highest obligation of a human being. And certainly my high school authorities took the view that anybody who made waves was just not being the right kind of student. So that emphasis on conformity annoyed me. And in a way, these religious devotions also struck me as against individualism, in the sense that everybody was supposed to believe in exactly the same kind of thing, take the same view of the Bible or the same view of God.
Ellery Shemp says he went to church every Sunday. His parents took him to the Unitarian Church, where he heard preachers and rabbis and bishops and various theologians. He also had an English teacher who encouraged free thinking, and Ellery was part of a Thursday evening discussion group where he and his fellow students worked on their essays.
We discussed things that teenagers were interested in, sex and the school authorities and sex and political events of the day. And
sex. But characterize that group for me. Were you a bunch of troublemakers?
No, not at all. You know, we were in honors classes. So I brought up this question one time. I said, well, you know, there is a First Amendment, and it says very clearly, it seems to me, that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of a religion. And here we have a clearly Judeo-Christian practice in the public schools. And it was not Muslim, it was not Buddhist, it was not free-thinking, it was not Hindu. And I said that this seemed to me a clear violation. And after all, in civics class, we're learning to respect the wisdom of our founding fathers and the Constitution. And in science class, we try to learn about geology and how the world actually works, and that doesn't have anything to do with Noah's flood and the book of Genesis. So why are we having these Bible readings? You know, and we had lots of back and forth. And at one time, it looked like maybe three or four my fellows would join with me in making a protest about this.
Did you have any idea at that time what form the protest would take?
No, we discussed various things. I had liked the idea that we would just pick other religious holy scriptures, such as the Koran or the Bhagavad Gita, and try to read those when it was our turn for Bible reading. But as time came closer, the others began to drop out. They mentioned it to their folks. The folks were totally against it. Some of them were decidedly fearful about whether this would hurt their chances for college. So it came down to whether I was going to do something, and I decided that I would.
Well, did you talk to your mother and father about it?
I mentioned that I was concerned about this as a practice when I was coming home from Grandma's after Thanksgiving, actually in November, from the back seat of the car. So I knew that they would be in general agreement that this was an infringement of separation of church and state. But I hadn't told them precisely what I planned to do. But what I did was I went to my friend George. He happened to have a copy of the Koran. So I asked George if I could borrow it, and did. Of course, nobody knew what the Koran was back in those days, including me. But I just wanted to use it as an example that there were other holy scriptures in the world besides the Bible.
But help me for a moment here. You were clearly a smart kid. You were thinking about what was going on around you. You would have also been aware that too. Take on the high school at a time when high school and parents, you know, which one do we obey more? You know, in many cases, high school matters more because the peer pressure is there. So you're gonna take on high school in the years right after the McCarthy era, when people were being blacklisted for challenges more trivial than this. Were you thinking at the time that the consequences of your act could be greater than whatever happened in the classroom or in the school?
I thought that it was so trivially obvious that this was a violation of the First Amendment. I thought that it was merely pointed out, you know, the grown-ups would correct the problem. But what I did on that Monday morning is I brought my borrowed copy of the Koran to school.
Did you smuggle it in? Were you a little nervous about this? What were you thinking?
There was no problem because I had, you know, math books, science books, English books, and just brought it to school. But the rules were that when the Bible reading started, all chatter had to stop. You had to put away any homework or other schoolwork and listen, or at least pretend to listen attentively. And then you had to stand for the Lord's Prayer. So what I did is I simply opened the Koran and read it silently to myself, and I did not stand for the Lord's Prayer.
Were you drawing attention to yourself? Were people looking at you going, what's Ellery doing?
I don't think so until the Lord's Prayer. I mean, it was very obvious if I remained seated and everybody else was standing. And then I stood, for the flag salute and sat down, and the reaction was pretty fast. The teacher came over and said, well, you know, what's going on here? And I said, well, I'd been thinking about it, and as a matter of religious conscience, I could no longer participate in the morning devotions. I think it's fair to say he was somewhat speechless. So he didn't know what to do, so he sent me to the principal, And I said, well, look, I'd been reading the First Amendment, and I said I thought that the Founding Fathers meant what they said, and that that this was a violation. And it produced a good bit of cognitive dissonance. And
yeah, but the poor guy would have had to do something. I mean, that's what principals do. He would have had to say, all right, Shemp, you're going to have to sit out Bible reading, or you're going to have to stand outside. What did he do? What was his decision?
He didn't actually have that authority because of the state law. But what he did is he sent me to the school guidance counselor. He said, well, nothing much I can do now. And so sent me back to classes.
She sent you back to class. This was on the day of your protest, right?
Yes, that's right, yes.
Did the other students come up to you after class or lunch break or something and say, what's going, what happened?
Yeah, quite a number of the desk and wanted to know whether I suffered any punishments or anything. And I said, no, this is just related to what I just told you.
When Ellery went home and told his folks, his father said he might need some legal help.
My father suggested that I write to the American Civil Liberties Union. So that's exactly what I did. I went and sat down with two fingers on my dad's typewriter, typed out a little letter asking the Philadelphia chapter of the ACLU whether they would be able to provide some assistance in challenging this Pennsylvania Bible reading and prayer practice. I enclosed a $10 bill. Now, that was rather significant.
I said, that's a lot of money in 1956.
It's probably close to $100 in today's money, yes. And so that actually got their attention, not only because they were feeling poor, but because they thought, well, a kid who can save up this money from grass cutting and his allowance or something is serious.
Back at school, Ellery Shemp would go each morning to homeroom for attendance. And then before morning devotions began, he'd go and sit outside the guidance counselor's office. In the meantime, lawyers with the American Civil Liberties Union assigned someone to look into the case. And one of them, a man called Bernie Wolfman, came out to interview the family, including his younger sister, Donna.
Bernie Wolfman, who was their lead attorney, we wanted to advise us, first of all, that if they're going to take this matter to the courts, it was probably going to have some repercussions, social repercussions, and were we prepared for it. My sister Donna, Bernie had asked Donna, what did she believe about, Jesus or God or something? And Donna looked at him, she was maybe 11 or 12 at the time, and looked at him and said, you're Jewish, aren't you? And Bernie was a little surprised. Said, yeah, I am. And she said, well, Unitarians are sort of like Jews. They have many, many different beliefs and come from many different traditions. And Bernie said that he was so impressed. He said, how could I not go back to the board and make a favorable recommendation after that?
Though Ellery Shemp was making legal headway with the ACLU, the high school principal was making life hard for him. This, after all, was the time when Ellery and his classmates were applying to college.
The normal practice was that your transcripts and recommendations from the teachers you had asked would go to the guidance counselor who was responsible for sending out to the college that you applied to. In my case, the principal asked for my college transcripts to always cross his desk, and he wrote a letter of disrecommendation to every school that I applied to.
Thank you very much.
In fact, and incidentally, I was admitted to every place that I applied to, except Harvard, where I was put on the waiting list.
I'm going to make sure that principals do this, write a letter of disrecommendation. Sounds like it helped you out.
I think it might have.
Now, legal cases like this one take some time. It wasn't until well into Ellery Shemp's senior year that the case made it to court, and he was already in college when the decision was announced. I'll talk with him about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The argument over the place of prayer in public school has long been a contentious one. And it never seems to go away. This afternoon, the case goes once again before a court in Illinois as one family pushes for an end to the so-called moment of silence in schools. Christian groups are equally determined to defend this law, insisting that, quote, every student has a constitutional right to pray in public school at any time or place as long as it's not disruptive and does not interfere with classroom instruction. Unquote. I'm talking today with a man who challenged the school rules 50 years ago. Ellery Shemp was a high school student in Pennsylvania who said he didn't want to take part in morning devotions, Bible reading. His case went all the way to the Supreme Court. He remembers when the first three-judge panel ruled in his favor.
There was a rather emotional meeting called of the citizens of Abington Township to discuss the case and what should the school board do. And so they voted quite overwhelmingly to carry on the appeal process. And then they had to vote to raise their taxes so that they could pay for their attorneys. And my parents were in the audience and saw that their taxes were going to be raised to fight us.
Were your parents?
But that's the way the system works.
Yeah, but what was it like for your parents to sit in that school board meeting knowing that it had been your protest that got this whole thing started? Did they suffer any social repercussions?
My brother was roughed up and pushed around a couple times. And sometimes when the school bus went by the house, kids would roll down the window and shout, "We're now passing the commie camp." My sister, however, Donna, she was 12, 13 in those years, and she felt that it was a big social embarrassment. That's an age when kids, girls especially, I think, want to be joiners and have their clique of friends around them and not want to stand out. Well, this unfortunately made her stand out. Then there were a number of very serious discussions around the family dinner table. Was this a right thing to do? Were we impinging our religious views on Donna? And although she intellectually agreed with us, emotionally it was a tough thing for her.
Did that cause some kind of a rift between you and Donna?
Yes, it did. I joke that I think that only recently has she come in to forgive me. It's a bit of a joke. Intellectually she has no question about it, but she has voiced her concerns when similar cases have come up and said, well, I wonder whether the parents are taking into account all the emotional needs of their kids when they get them involved in some notorious case of this kind. So she has, she feels that there's a bit of a scar, I guess.
I bet this became an even bigger deal when it went all the way to the Supreme Court then. Tell me about that.
Finally, the Supreme Court had its scheduled a hearing. That was in February of 1963. I remember that our family all gathered down in Washington at the Supreme Court building, and it was quite a thrill to be sitting in the front row of the gallery listening to the lawyers make their arguments. And there were attorneys general from several different states who filed amicus briefs and also had brief moments to state their case that this was an issue about teaching morals and civic responsibility, and it had nothing to do with establishing religion. Well, the court, as it turned out, didn't buy that argument, and in June of 1963, the Supreme Court ruled in an 8-1 decision that the Pennsylvania practices were unconstitutional and a violation of the First Amendment.
Where were you when you finally heard the court's decision?
By this time, 63, I had already graduated from Tufts, and I was finished my first year of graduate school at in physics at Brown University,
right.
And I'd gotten married earlier that same June. So Josephine and I were actually on our honeymoon camping across the country on our way to Yellowstone. So we were in the, I don't know, wilds of South Dakota or someplace, and we heard a brief announcement that the Supreme Court had made this decision. So I very much wanted to see how, what the evening news on CBS News, how they would report it or something. But I remember that we got off the highway and started looking for motels, and we went in and tried to explain the situation. Could we have a room where we could just watch television for an hour?
Sure, buddy. Can I see your marriage license?
Well, the clerk wasn't even going to have that. We tried a couple times and without success, but eventually we did find a larger hotel or something that actually had a TV in the lobby. Most hotels in those days didn't have TVs in their lobby, so
right.
We did actually able to watch it. That was a little funny.
Well, I mean, it's funny to imagine that now in 1963. I mean, if that were to happen today, you'd have CBS and CNN and the New York Times and NPR and everyone chasing you across the country. There he is. There's the guy. Look, you know, what's he think? What was your reaction?
I was obviously very happy and called home and asked how the folks were doing and what did they all think, and everybody was extremely happy.
Was there any backlash, against you?
I think we were not prepared for a big backlash. We thought that the people would respect the Constitution and the court's decision. And President Kennedy made a very nice statement. He recognized that it was controversial and said, but, you know, look, something to the effect that it wasn't the end of the world. And quoting him as best I recall, he said, "I'm sure we can all do a little more praying in our homes and in our churches and in our synagogues. So we don't have to pray in the public schools." That did a bit to diffuse some of the anger. In fact, Herblock, the famous cartoonist for the Washington Post, had a wonderful cartoon that shows a grumpy old dad reading his newspaper over the breakfast table, and he's pounding the table and says, "What's the Supreme Court expect us to do, listen to the damn kids pray at home?" But then there were, some really very vicious remarks made. I think it was Senator Eastland from Mississippi who got up on the floor of the Senate. This is only a short time after the desegregation issues. And said, "Well, the Supreme Court has put the niggers in and thrown God out."
What about the mail? Did your family get any hate mail over this?
Over the next 6 months or so, we got about 5,000 letters, and they came roughly into thirds. About a third were supportive, a third where people of goodwill might reasonably disagree, and they usually had return addresses, and then the remaining third were simply hateful and vituperative.
Did you think at the time, okay, we're done with that, let's move on, no more church and school?
I did, and I thought it was nobody could read this without it seeming to be fair and balanced and good for government and good for religion, that religion by rote is not a valuable spiritual or religious experience.
But you were wrong. I mean, this has been an issue almost since the day of the judgment. I pick up the recent newspapers and I see stories from Texas about the Religious Viewpoints Anti-Discrimination Act, stories from South Carolina about teaching the Bible as a scholarly pursuit rather than a religious pursuit, about a story about a football coach in New Jersey who says it's okay if he kneels to pray with his students. And I mean, we're every bit as much in the middle of this story today as you were when you were 16 years old, Ellery.
Well, maybe so. But it's the pendulum always swings. And I think the pendulum has swung away from the religious right now. I think that the idea that faith-based government will somehow be superior has proven not to be true. And I think that the next era is going to be based on pragmatic considerations for what makes good government. I think that
you're going to have to hold your breath until the personnel in the Supreme Court changes before that to be actually played out judicially, aren't you?
You are extremely right about that. I don't think that our case or any of the related cases would make it through this particular Supreme Court.
I have one more question for you, Ellery, and it's kind of a personal one. I mean, you went on from that moment to become a physicist and a professor and a writer, and yet I wonder if anything that you have done in your life has had the impact of that one act that you chose to take part in when you were 16 years old, carrying a Quran into a high school Bible class. I mean, is it true to look at it with that kind of weight?
Well, there's no question. I mean, this was a unique moment and a unique experience, and it's forever linked with me and my family. But it's not what one individual does. There's a system out there, and I think it was a triumph of the American scheme of things that, you know, a very average family was able to bring a constitutional case and have it adjudicated. I think that was special. And
yeah, it's
special.
Pretty neat.
Not about us, but about our country.
Just that, exactly. Ellery, thank you so much for being with me on the program today.
It was a great delight to be with you, Dick.
I talked with Ellery Shemp from a studio in Boston, where he now works. If you want to read more about his story, there's a book. It's called Ellery's Protest, and we have a link to that on our website. You can find it at thestory.org. Our stories about religion and spiritual matters always bring us thoughtful responses and suggestions for other stories. Here's one. Barbara Allen grew up in a very strict evangelical home in Elyria, Ohio. She didn't much like the kind of rules that her parents enforced, but she stuck with them. She even went on to Bob Jones University. Eventually, she left the evangelical side of Christianity, but her story is that she still keeps close what she believes is the essence of her faith. I asked her to take me back to what she was taught as a child.
We considered, of course, that Catholic and all of the other Protestants were the other, and we, being the fundamentalist evangelical Christians, were the true Christians. And that was the main divide that I had in mind. We had very clear lines, and we were taught very young to tell the difference between them and us. And you could tell them easily if they smoked.
Because no one in your church smoked.
Nobody in my church smoked. We weren't even allowed to dance or listen to rock music or, popular things.
How many times a week would you go to church as a little girl?
Well, always Wednesday nights and Sunday morning and Sunday evening. And then twice a year there were revivals, which meant we went every night.
And how long would those last?
Until everybody came forward.
So it might be 5 days, 6 days.
Oh, yeah, that was 1 week. But the services themselves tended to go on because it was important to have a lot of conversions and rededications. If you felt you were out of the will of God, if you'd backslidden, if you'd done anything wrong or gotten away from God in any way, then you were to come forward and rededicate your life to the Lord.
Was there any joy in this church?
There was a lot of fear. I think there was joy in some homes. My home was not a joyful home. There were some people who did really enjoy it. And the singing was good. I still miss the music.
Yeah.
But the main factor, from my standpoint, was fear. In the 40s and 50s, that was, you know, there was a lot about Red Scares, communism, the end of the world, the second coming. You know, in school, we got down under our desks to protect ourselves from a bomb. And then at church, we heard about the imminence of the second coming. So it was a pretty much seven-day feast of terror. It was really a scary time.
You mentioned to me that there wasn't a lot of joy in your own home. What
right.
was going on there?
Well, it was just a bad marriage. I mean, my parents were just not meant for each other and did the best they could, but they just probably shouldn't have been married in the first place. And of course, my dad was a Baptist minister, so when you've got the layer of having to look good on top of the dysfunction, it makes a great strain because everyone, you have to look good. It's a bad testimony to admit that you're unhappy. And this was before there were psychologists and psychiatrists, and even if there were, we wouldn't have been able to go to them because you were supposed to be able to just pray and get guidance and be healed through your religion. And if that's not possible, then you just weren't doing it right.
Was your father a preacher in that Church of the Open Door?
By the time I came along, he had left the ministry, but you never really leave the ministry. Once you're ordained, it's kind of like being a doctor. You've got this title and this on you. So he was active as a layperson in the church, but, you know, people addressed him as Reverend, and that was awkward too.
What was the physical space like, the church itself? What are your childhood memories of that?
Well, we prided ourselves in very plain architecture. So our church was cement block, it was painted beige, there was no artwork, there was never a cross. It was also the Midwest, I mean, that was in the culture too, to be very modest, to be practical. And you think of artists as, you know, rather unstable bohemians that you don't want your kid to marry. So the church itself was just almost bare. I had a friend, my closest friend was Catholic, which got me into sort of trouble, but I would go to her church, for instance. It was right near our high school, and of course it was always open. And we would go sometimes in just to sort of look around. And when I walked into that Catholic church, I thought I was in another world. It was so gorgeous and so solemn and colorful, and I really, you know, it wouldn't have surprised me to see elephants come down the aisle. It was very exotic to me. It was very romantic. And to contrast that with my church was just the absolute opposite.
Did you feel like you were doing something wrong by even stepping into her church?
Yeah, I was very uneasy. Yeah. And then I was especially ashamed of envy. I mean, I felt envy for people who got to come to this gorgeous place. And then I felt ashamed of that because, of course, my own people were good people, and they were living according to the light that they had. And it's just that I just didn't fit in. I felt like I'd maybe been left on the doorstop by some gypsies.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story and the voices of people who are living their lives in the news. Barbara remembers that her family was held in high regard in the community.
My parents had been missionaries before I was born, so a lot of my heroes were missionaries, a lot of the friends of my parents. They were a little like movie stars to me. They were missionaries in Africa or Japan or whatever. So when they would come back and show slides and tell about their lives and sing Jesus Loves Me in Swahili, it was very exotic, and it was a kind of my window onto the world. This was before television, and we couldn't go to movies. But one couple went, the woman of the couple got involved with another man and got pregnant. So she came home in huge disgrace. I mean, this was a big, big scandal. And when she had the baby, she had twins, which seemed doubly bad somehow. And when the first Sunday after she had the twins and was able, she came to church, and people were absolutely appalled. They said, there she came down the front with those twins, you know. And even as a 12 or 13-year-old, I thought, what is she supposed to do? I mean, she'd obviously stepped outside of her marriage vows. She'd had an affair. She'd gotten pregnant. But everyone is supposed to come to church. Everyone is supposed to come on Sunday to church. And the children, the babies, it wasn't their fault. She at least came. And I remember they seemed to think that she should just stay home and hide. And that seemed to contradict our belief that all are welcome. The hymn says, just as I am, even if you've got your two little bastards, just as I am, means to come in whatever state you have, come to the Lord. And seemed like that's what she was doing, but somehow those standards kind of changed sometimes.
At that age, 12, 13, 14, Barb, were you beginning to have second thoughts about your own faith? Were you thinking to yourself, you know, what am I supposed to believe if it's really harsh on someone who's, you know, been in trouble, that sort of thing?
Well, this is the dilemma, is that this is where most people, I think, throw out the baby with the bathwater. This is where most people say, hell with it. This is not for me. I don't feel this way. I'm smart. I like to read. These people don't want me to read. They're anti-intellectual. Look down on college professors and authors. And I thought, so this is the time where you could just say, as soon as I'm out of here, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
But I really did love the Lord, and I really did think that I was a Christian. And I guess it's partly pride and partly stubbornness that I was going to hold on to that. I really decided I was a Christian, and I may disagree with these people, and they may not think I'm a Christian, but underneath, of course, this was all very underneath. I read Bonhoeffer and Tiklica and these, the kind of where other people might sneak Playboy. I was reading German theologians.
Barbara Allen says the theologians and philosophers led her to an understanding that there were different ways to be a Christian. And I'll talk with her more about that and where she is now in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I'm talking with Barbara Allen. She was raised in a family of missionaries, evangelical fundamentalist Christians, as she describes them. Once she started reading theologians, though, she came to a new understanding of her faith.
The idea that a person can be a Christian agnostic was fascinating to me, and I held on to that because a Christian knows certain things. And in my world, if you knew certain things, then you knew everything. Mm-hmm. You could expound on, you know, how to vote and how to live and how to spend your money and everything. An agnostic, on the other hand, says, it's kind of unknowable. I don't know, and I don't think you can know. So I decided that that's what I was.
But how old were you when you figured this out, Barb?
I was in high school and kept very quiet about it. But then, see, I wasn't really allowed to go to a secular school. All my friends got to choose their college. I had to go to a fundamentalist college.
Which one did you go to?
Bob Jones. And I was only 16 because since my parents had been missionaries, I kind of started school early and graduated early. And of course, that was kind of frying pan into the fire. it's even to the right of where I'd gone to church. And in a way, it was pleasant because I was surrounded by people who were okay. I mean, before I couldn't date, I had to be careful, you know, where I went and went. And down there, everybody believed the same as we had believed. So I got to be on the school newspaper because I always wanted to write. I couldn't really do that stuff in a secular high school. So in a way, it was a relief.
But you still couldn't walk through the quad holding hands with a boy at that.
Oh, no. You couldn't touch another. No, it's all the rules that you've heard are true.
Yeah, okay.
But see, I was 16, and I was on the shy side, and that wasn't bad for me. I wasn't ready for boys anyway. And, you know, I liked boys and wanted to date, but I wasn't ready for sex. So that was not so bad for me to have these strong rules that kind of protected me. And you didn't feel like you were going to get in any awkward situations in the backseat of a car. But you weren't even allowed in the car. So in a way, it was wonderful to have this orderly. I'd come from a very chaotic home to come to an orderly campus where you got up at this, you know, the bell rings at 6:30, there's devotions, and then there's breakfast and so forth. It's almost like a convent, and it's comforting to have things just laid out for you. But of course, I did continue to read and think, and I did see a lot of things that I certainly didn't agree with and didn't like.
What ways other students were treated? Give me an example of something.
Of course, I had one friend who, now we would say she's lesbian. I don't know that I even knew the word back then. And she just disappeared. She was actually put against her will into a mental institution in Southeast Alabama. I knew that she was a good person and she loved the Lord and she was a good friend, and she was treated very badly, like she was a criminal. And then she was locked up into an insane asylum, which of course was her mother's choice, not Bob Jones. But something was amiss here. I knew that.
Barbara says her own life took a dramatic turn while she was at Bob Jones University.
You know, having not dated or been really even had a boyfriend up until then, I fell for the first guy that fell for me and got married way too young.
How old were you?
And I was 18 and had my first child at 19.
How old was he?
Bob Jones, 21.
Yeah.
His parents were on the faculty there, and he was an upperclassman. And I had my first baby I had my first son at Bob Jones University Hospital.
Were you allowed to stay as a student if you were a young married student at that point?
Not the girls. And of course, I got pregnant quickly, so no. I faded into the background. I typed his papers.
How did that marriage work out?
Not well. He went into the ministry. We were married 18 years and moved 16 times. It was very restless. He was a very restless fellow. And it was not a happy marriage. There was abuse and infidelity. And there was no place to go for help. You know, you can't go to your minister because you're married to him. And it would look disloyal to let anybody in on what was going on. So I was really felt trapped. Plus having no education and no money and no family to go back to and three little kids, there didn't seem to be an out.
It was still this sense of appearances counting almost more than anything else that kept
That's
you
right.
in that marriage?
That's right, because it's a good testimony. If you're a Christian and if you're the light of the world, you have to present a happy, whole, healthy image to people so that they'll be drawn to Christ. And if you don't do that, if you're frank and if you're truthful about how things really are, then you're really letting down the Lord and the whole community.
Are you thinking anymore at this time, Barb, that the whole Christian package is really not such a good deal? Or are you still thinking to yourself, the problem is not Christianity, the problem is some of the people who happen to be in it with me?
Right. Yeah, I was always able to separate Jesus from the church. And it was the particular slice of Christianity that I was in that I was running afoul of, that I didn't fit into. But I could look around and see that there were other denominations and that there were other ways of being a Christian. And even though the community that I was in would say, well, those people are all mistaken and they're going to hell, I really didn't think they were. And I really thought that I could leave this denomination, that I could go over to the more liberal, and I would still be a Christian.
After your first husband left and after you remarried, you did that, right? You separated
right.
yourself from the evangelical
right.
Upbringing that you'd had.
Right.
Where do you go to
church? It was sort of a slow, I went, you know, kind of Lutheran, Presbyterian, Episcopal. It was, you know, a few years here and a few years there. But then when I found the Episcopal Church, I felt like I was really home.
And it's a comfortable place for you now. You still go to church there.
Right.
Have you been back home to Elyria to see your folks?
My mother is 91, and so we go back often, and we always have to go to her church where my brother is the music minister. So it's a trip.
I was going to say.
It's a trip.
What's it
and
like?
Of course, I bring my children and grandchildren along, and my children include a pierced and tattooed lesbian, men with hair many different colors, and we're a diverse group. And when we go back, it's almost always over a weekend because it's very important to her to have her family in church. I can't believe that she still wants that, but she does. And to honor her, we go to that church. And it bothers me more than it does anybody else. My husband just floats above it. He doesn't really listen anyway. And my kids tolerate it okay. They're very courteous, and they love their grandma. But it's very, very hard for me.
I don't understand why it is hard for you. I mean, you have made so many deep kind of soul-searching decisions about what's right.
It's mainly sad. It's mainly really sad for me because it feels like getting into clothes that don't fit. And what I see is, I mean, we always project our feelings onto others. We always think, well, I would be very sad in this situation. So we see them as sad, and they may not be. But for instance, the music even will have, there's still that great anti-intellectualism. You won't find this in the science books. You know, you won't find this. They've got the answer.
But has that church itself changed? Or do you feel when you're in there with your family like everybody's looking at you with disapproving stares?
Not me, because I look just plain, but my family certainly stands out. And the preacher definitely focuses more over on our side of the church when he's preaching about salvation, because we're so obviously the sinners in the bunch.
So obviously in need of salvation.
That's right. We're just sitting there tattooed and going straight to hell.
So what would he say?
Well, he'd say a person would have to be an idiot not to accept Jesus.
What do your kids think?
At that point, Steve, my oldest son, leaned over and said, I'll tell you what an idiot is. So I think it's kind of humorous to them, and I don't like that either, because I don't like to make fun of another person's religion. But they're secure in what they are. Out of my three sons, only one goes to church, and the other one is sort of on and off. But church is not a big in their lives.
At some point in your years as a student, you had to choose a verse of some sort, didn't
you? That's right. And I don't know, I don't remember the process, but for some reason I chose John 1:5, which says, there is a light that shines in the world, and the darkness comprehendeth it not. This is, of course, the King James Version. And I chose that, and I don't know, I don't remember why, but it was a miracle, really, because that verse has stuck with me throughout all my different perambulations around the Christian church, because it's the one thing I do know for sure is that there is a light that shines in the darkness, and the darkness can't get it. The darkness will not put it out. This doesn't mean that the world is getting any better. I mean, look around. It's still very dark. There's a lot of darkness out there. The light doesn't put the darkness out, but the light does shine, and the darkness can't get it. The darkness will never overcome it. And you can, you know, I've reached the point where I think you can call the light different things. You can call it Jesus or Lord or another term, but it doesn't take away the power of the light that shines in the darkness.
Barbara Allen says that her own comfort with her Christianity today means that she's less accepting of people who try to tell her what God really wants. She remembers one incident that took place when she was sitting on an airplane.
I was next to a man who was an acquaintance of mine. We were coming back from the West, and he was a converted Jew, a born-again Christian. And so he was expounding on his ideas, particularly on secular humanism in schools, and how we have to come out from among them and be separate, which means to go to a Christian school. He was on the window side, and I was on the aisle seat. And I looked past him and saw this incredible, in all the years I've traveled all over the world, I've never seen clouds like this. They were bright, huge valleys and mountains, just the most dramatic cloud scene I'd ever been in. In fact, the whole cabin had gotten quiet because people were just bedazzled by this. And this guy was talking. Of course, he was facing me, and he was working himself up into somewhat of a lather. And finally, I just stopped him for a minute. I said, stop just a minute. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I want you to see this because I don't want you to miss that. And he looked out. And as he was looking out, I said to him, do you think that the God who created that really cares about secular humanism in public schools? He said to me, well, no, but people really eat that stuff up. So you see, he had a shtick.
Right.
He was on a lecture.
He was practicing.
He was doing it, and he was high. I mean, people were listening to him and listening to every word he said, and they were eating it up. And the contrast between these really minor differences in doctrine and these little quibbly things that we get into in the church, the contrast between that and whoever had made this splendid scene, he did get it for a minute there.
But this sort of brings us back to this book that you read as a high school student, the Weatherhead book, Christian Agnostic,
right.
because that's right. that's about being very comfortable with your core beliefs as a Christian and yet willing to sort of look out the airplane window and go,
right.
I don't know who made those clouds, or
I don't know,
you know, what's in the mind of whatever force in creation
right.
Put us all together. Are
right.
you still as comfortable with all the questions?
I know. It's a mystery. And if God were not a mystery, God couldn't be God. I mean, if we could figure out God, that would mean he or she is very small.
But, you know, it's interesting, Barbara, you were talking about arriving as a young, kind of very green kid at Bob Jones University and embracing structure and embracing
right.
all that, in a way embracing the certainty that you didn't have. And I think that organized religion in almost every faith capitalizes on that, where there
right.
is uncertainty, the church offers certainty. You know, we'll fill in
That's
all
right.
those blanks for you.
The fastest growing churches in this country today are those that give you all the answers. They even have their own bowling league. I mean, you can really, you know, join a church and be there every night, and they'll tell you how to vote, how to spend your money, how to raise your children. And those are the fastest growing churches. And I think it's because of the chaos in the world, and I think people are drawn to anybody who seems to have all the answers. I just don't see it as having integrity with how things really are. Ultimately, we're each responsible for our own decisions. And to do something just because somebody else has told you to do it, somewhere in your life that's going to fall apart. Some people, I guess, might be lucky and they might get through their whole lives, you know, with a good marriage and good job and so forth. But I don't see any of those people.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story, where we hear from people whose own experiences have them living out what's in the news. Barbara Allen works in a hospital as a part of her church work.
Last year I walked into a hospital room. I didn't know the people. They go to our church, but I didn't know them. And there were two surgeons there that were telling them that their newborn baby was going to need heart surgery. So I stepped in, but I kind of stepped back because you're never sure about privacy issues and your role. I mean, I didn't want to interrupt any mm-hmm. discussion. Or anyway, they said, no, come on in. And the two surgeons stayed with us and said the Lord's Prayer together. So we had this beautiful moment just before they were ready to take this baby off to have surgery, where we were one. And I don't know what their religion was. I know what the parents were Episcopalians. But I think there's a divide that is just overcome when the stakes are high enough. I think we do this. We can be one with Muslims and Jews and Christians. I think we can all recognize how much we have in common and how much we love God and want the best for each other. And at a time like that, all doctrinal differences fall away. They just fall away. It's like a veil that just goes away, and we are just humans.
I was going to say, what's left when all that falls away? What's left?
Well, we have each other, and we have our beliefs in the Lord. And the core thing is that there is this light that shines in the darkness. And you can call it by different names, but it shines, and the darkness comprehendeth it not.
That's Barbara Allen. She talked with me from a studio in Atlanta, Georgia. If you have a story about the way that you use faith or spirituality to make sense of the world, or if you don't use faith or spirituality to make sense of the world, get in touch with me. Send me a note through our website. You can find me at thestory.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Story, we'll talk about the price of oil, the price of gas. That $3 gallon looks like it's here to stay, and that's real. But what about the $7 gallon? What happens then? Senior officials in Washington have been put through a kind of reality game called oil shockwave so they can imagine what might happen. It's the same kind of exercise, the same kind of game that Ken Eklund led on the web, allowing anyone to join in.
There were people who were hoarding quite a bit of gasoline. They were filling up drums, essentially,
uh-huh.
And buying, of course, you know, the 5-gallon containers or whatever and filling those up. And so there were, you know, stacks of those in the garage. we experienced kind of our first protests, people burning cars actually in San Francisco and other expressions of anger and disquiet at kind of the perceived inequity which is about to occur just begins to happen at that time.
It's called A World Without Oil, and that's our story tomorrow. If you have any suggestions for stories, ideas, or interesting ways that people are trying to figure out how they can make it through a world where the price of gas is high and the price of food is getting higher, get in touch with me. You can either send me a letter to The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, 27517. That's 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The zip code's 27517. Or just scribble out a few lines on our website. That's thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.